And we are back on a Sunday, snowy Sunday morning. This is the Heritage Radio Network. This is The Main Course. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. My cohort, Patrick Martins, is on the other end of the phone, I think, right?
Hey, Katie.
Hi, Patrick.
What are you doing?
Drinking Irish coffee.
I can tell you love me because you talk in such a ridiculously high voice. The higher, the more the love.
That's right. It's just like when you love your pets or your babies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can measure that.
Like, when you first met me, you were like, I don't know if I want to do radio.
No, actually, there was never a moment's hesitation, Patrick. I'm such a show off. Are you kidding? So did you guys get the big snowstorm?
What's the weather like over there?
Actually, the sun is coming out, and it's unbelievably beautiful. And it was the city was silent for hours this morning, which was just divine. That's my favorite thing of a heavy snowfall. They hadn't plowed them yet.
Wow. So, and Brooklyn must be tough. I mean, how many inches, like, on an average street?
Well, on the some of the picnic tables out here in the back of Roberta's, I'd say there's a good foot of snow.
I think it was about a foot.
And I know Brenton has been working hard to get the snow off the greenhouses on top and everything, and his feet are soaking wet and freezing cold. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, there's plenty of snow.
How is the studio holding up with leaks and all that?
I don't see any leaks. Guys, you see any leaks in the engineering booth?
Was that a sound effect?
No, it was an actual leak.
It was Jack drowning.
Oh, my God. Poor Jack. Well, he was good while he lasted.
May he live forever. So, Patrick, tell us what's going on. Well, we have Erica Demain in the studio to talk about Christmas feasting. And she has some really interesting material for us. Then Gina DePalma is going to call in from her house up in Westchester.
One of the best pastry chefs in America.
In America, absolutely. Gina DePalma from Baba Restaurant. And then last but not least, we have Divya Gunyani from Behind the Burner, which is that fancy, slick new website where like all things culinary are happening.
Wow.
Did you look
exciting.
At that? It was really interesting. I mean, she's got a lot of corporate backing there. I'm not quite sure. I didn't check the advertising roster, but it looked very impressive. She has a lot of high-end chefs.
It sounds like you're going to need the full hour and a half.
Something like that.
Something like that. Yeah, Jack and Nat are like, what?
No, they're not. They're prepared. I sent them an outline.
I'm kidding.
Those boys are ready for anything.
I'm here in Libertyville. Mm-hmm. And just north of Chicago, and it also is full of snow. And I just had a Christmas extravaganza. I think they were like 300 Saxelbys, which is the last name of Anne's family.
Yeah.
300-400 maybe. And they were all here, and there were so many people, you can't know everyone by name, so everyone is just giving a number and a color code.
Yeah.
So I was red 11, and they were like, red 11, come pick up your man purse. I got a little toiletry bag. So that was fun.
That sounds excellent.
They made a delicious brisket. Really? Anyway, so, you know, I'm so happy, Katie, you were, you know, I know phone's not the best, but, you know, this is the last show of the year.
And I
just wanted to, you know, before you start, you know, the show, wanted just to say a few things that, you know, had been kind of on my mind. Is that cool? Like, just for a little, like, three-minute intro?
Please talk as long as you want, Patrick. I was expecting you to go on for at least 15 or 20 minutes,
frankly. Oh, okay.
Frankly.
Well, I can do that,
too.
So,
feel free. Yeah.
Well, first of all, you know, I think, you know, the HRN is absolutely the people that are a part of it. And, Katie, no one has shown up and been there and brought it more than you.
Oh, come on. Thank you, Patrick.
I mean, this is a big show, the Sunday show. You know, if it's Sunday, it's the main course. You know, I'm sorry that Meet the Press ripped that off from us like 40 years ago, but... and then, you know, Jack Inslee and Nat Wiener.
Talk about showing up.
Yeah, when you start a network like that, I mean, if you don't have two guys like that, you know, to man the fort, you know, day in and day out, I mean, it's not going to be successful. And, you know, all the hosts, you know, and the guys at Roberta's, I mean, could
amazing.
There be a better place to do a radio station, like, in the world?
No, it's the happiest place I know.
Yeah. So, you know, it was just a very, very exciting year. You know, it's our first year. We made a lot of improvements, you know, to the website and to the technology. We're going to be adding a lot of new features. But, you know, I thought since this is the last show of the year, I would just speak a couple of minutes about, you know, what has so inspired me about this kind of movement to create a voice, to, you know, broadcast these issues that are so important to us, and in really no particular order. They're just three things. You know, from the food perspective, you know, since we were started kind of as a food site, I just wanted to say we are following, you know, I spent 2 years desk to desk, I mean, literally in the same room with Carlo Petrini, mm-hmm. who is the founder of Slow Food. And one of the biggest things that, you know, has inspired me about him, and one of the things that I think is most forgotten and lost by the American public, especially the, you know, religious, sustainable people, is that, you know, Slow Food was absolutely never, not for a day, ever intended to be a local food movement. Mm-hmm. And it was always about quality and taste. And that was the number one. Carlo never cared where his olive came from, but he wanted the best olive in the world, or the best olive Italy had to offer, or he wanted the best after-dinner drink, or he wanted, you know, the best grappa, or he wanted the best eggplant. He didn't care if it came from Sicily or Tuscany or Val d'Aosta. He wanted the best. And, you know, I think that sometimes it's a disservice to local producers to say, hey, you're local, so you're automatically number one. When in reality, in the whole country, they might be number 9 or number 12 for a certain product that they're producing. And, you know, I think that, you know, gastronomy is a science. As Carlo always said, there's a right and a wrong with it. You know, even though one guy might like a certain wine, you know, they are great wines and they are bad wines. And I just think it's very important that the Heritage Radio Network station work to elevate culture and education and quality, and not just espouse, you know, a little sliver of the overall message, which is that we are about broadcasting quality things. And, you know, we don't get co-opted by any individual, you know, philosophy. I mean, does that make sense, Katie?
Yeah, I agree. I think that does make a lot of sense. I think that people, you know, get caught up in the whole sort of locavore movement as if that's the holy grail. And
sometimes it is.
You know, yeah, it's great when it works. But we're a nation of many millions of people, and it's not always possible to implement those kinds of practices. It's just not economically viable. And until it is, you know, it's about working with the system that we have to improve it. It's not about throwing it all out of the window and saying, I can only buy something that was grown 30 miles away.
Yeah, absolutely. And listen, oftentimes the local food is the best food, you know, and it is the most nutritious. And when that is, that's great, you know, but it is, you know, I would rather that New York State farmers raise what's in their wheelhouse, like their bread and butter, like, you know, dried cherries, apples.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I mean, is that the best place to grow, you know, I don't know, Concord grapes? Maybe, maybe not. If it's not, then I don't want a Concord grape from New York. I could care less that it's local. You know, same with the pork or beef. So anyway, I just think, you know, the HRN has done great through our shows, Urban Foragers, you know, Hot Grease, Why We Cook, you know, just about really, truly spotlighting the very best America has to offer. And, you know, radio is a great medium for it. The other thing, you know, the point two is that what I love about Roberta's and Heritage Foods, which is the main sponsor for HRN and also HRN, there's no feasibility study. We didn't do any feasibility study. We just
no focus groups. Yeah, right.
That's focus groups and feasibility studies for what we do, which is trying to help farmers or artisans, is it's a waste, I think, oftentimes of taxpayer money. And, you know, I think that, you know, these people get 501c3 status and then proceed to do 7,000 feasibility studies for the smallest little circle of academics and you know, certain people. And you know, I have to say, I am, you know, it really gets my goat and sickens me that so many people talk such talk and how few people are actually ready to make a concrete act you know, from consumers, you know, who could spend a little bit extra time to seek out a better product. But, you know, all the way to, you know, I hear all this talk about wanting to change school lunch in the public school system. Yeah. I mean, absolutely, there's no more room for talk or waiting for policy. And I think policy changes based off vigilante tactics that push policy to have to, you know, to not be able to ignore anymore, you know, certain issues. And there's a group who I'd love to have on one day, Revolution Foods, out in California. From nothing, they opened a catering hall and today produce 40,000 meals for public schools that is within about 70 cents of what the government allots per meal. And the rest of the money, the difference, they just raised it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, talk about an inspiring story.
Yeah, we definitely should. That sounds like a wonderful guest.
You know, and I have to say,
I'm going to reach out to them this week.
Slow food, you know, talking about it. I mean, that they had better. 2010 is their year for all the great things they do and believe in to show that all these sit-ins and all these feasibility studies actually lead to a single meal being changed. If they can point to one meal being changed for one kid in America, it is a complete success. But as long as it remains that not one meal is changed. So, I mean, you know, and that applies, by the way, to everything. You know, any good, clean, and fair activity in the country needs results now more than ever. And that leads me a little bit to the last thing now is just I think this HRN is unbelievable station because it has really brought to the forefront the artisans, the truckers, the carpenters, even, you know, army generals and special forces people, you know, real estate agents, people who are the concrete means to change. And, you know, as long as these people are left off of, you know, panels and feasibility studies, you know, or meetings, the world's not going to change. And, you know, I'm inspired by, you know, Chris Perichini and Roberta's and what else is happening in Brooklyn. I'm inspired by HRN and all of our hosts who bring it week in and week out. And anyway, I just kind of wanted to say that we are an active movement. We are not a passive one, and we're not about celebrating what's good in the world. We're about creating more good in the world, and I think that, you know, inspires me and keeps me wanting to grow HRN into the distant future.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, we're going to take it very, very wide this year, this coming year.
Yeah, and, so what's your favorite show on the network besides the main course?
Besides mine? You know, I love Hot Grease. I've listened to a few of those episodes, and I think Nicole is fabulous. I like Erica White's show a lot. Of course, I love Burning Down the House.
Burning Down the House, the only architect on the show.
One of the only architects in the country.
Who has a show like that?
Who broadcasts a show about architecture and design, yeah.
What about you and the studio, guys? I mean, what are your what shows inspire you having, you know, worked each show?
They're like chitter-chattering.
That's a good question. I'd say Catch a Cook and Eat It is pretty inspiring just because it's just a lot of fun, and it is fun every single week. And at first, I have to admit, I was a little bit skeptical of how much fun seafood could really be. But he proved me wrong.
That is hilarious. What about you, Jack?
I'm going to go with the main course.
Jack, oh my God. That's only because I'm here.
Well, because you're looking for a raise.
You know, Katie might book the guests, but you work a solid 6 days a week and still show up every Sunday, which kicks ass, so.
Well, that's awesome.
Hey,
thanks,
I work
Jack.
5 days a week, too, you know, Jack.
Well, I watch Patrick work. That's the difference.
Yeah, he has to actually sit next to me on Wednesdays.
Yeah, right?
He's like, how can he smoke weed and run a meat movement? No, just kidding.
We just lost our sponsors.
No, yeah, really. We didn't. But and thank you for bringing that up, Jack. You know, just before I sign off, you know, the Hearst Ranch, Fairway Market, you know, Whole Foods. I mean, Saks will be cheesemongers. I mean, you know, people who literally
Roberta's.
Pay cash.
Yeah.
Roberta's. I mean, they give all this food and support.
TechServe.
You know, to everybody, and it is just so inspiring. And I'm telling you, I am sick of hearing, you know, journalists receive awards. you know, they're true soldiers of this sustainability movement, you know, to either A, start new traditions, or B, create traditions where they didn't exist before. And, you know, I am sick of this monopoly controlling what we talk about and honoring the same tried and true three or four people, you know. Meanwhile, they are hundreds of people. Like, you know, I'll say it, you know, Paradise Locker Meets. Talk about what every single community needs, you know, an honest, active slaughterhouse, a custom slaughterhouse that understands the needs of the farmers and but also the final consumers. I mean, that's what we need. We need slaughterhouses. We need artisans. And damn it, you know, this station is going to be the one that puts them on air. And by the end of this year, 2010, the motto for our station, we cannot be denied. The people, the hosts, I mean, are absolutely going to be center stage. And, you know, we're going to have Scott Stringer on, the Manhattan Borough president, who one day I hope becomes mayor. You know, he's going to be a regular visitor on HRN.
Yes, he is.
My friend Sam, you know, I say friend, my colleague, my cohort, the guy who I know, Sam Cass at the White House. We're going to use that chip, you know, for good to get more things on the national stage. And I know, Katie, you have, you know, hundreds of things that you want to do, including especially with sustainable seafood, right? I mean, that's a big thing for you.
Yep. Seafood, school lunch. And then actually, speaking of slaughterhouses, I read an interesting piece recently on my favorite meat website about a new slaughterhouse that's opening in upstate New York.
Great.
With an ethanol production component, and they're going to have like a closed loop so that they're, I mean, it's going to be like a, you know, they're going to be doing what they do, which can be either environmentally very unfriendly, or it can be, we hope, environmentally sustainable. And they are aiming to be the first slaughterhouse that shows how you can run these two systems without actually damaging, you know, your immediate surrounding area. So that should be very interesting.
Now the challenge is to sell everything. But, you know, we've been talking, a small group of me, about talking about how the next challenge, and this is just a, you know, Heritage Foods does $7 million of business a year with small farms and slaughterhouses. So that gives me the moral authority to say what I'm going to say. By 2013, we're not going to Heritage Foods, working with its small group of people, which includes some people at Roberta's, will cure, not cure, but will offer the choice to every person in bad neighborhoods to have an alternative to fast food. So it's a solution to the obesity epidemic in the tri-state area. I know that's a big claim, but that's 4 years from now. I am claiming that Heritage Foods will offer every single inner-city child or adult an alternative to fast food. That sounds big, but, you know, if the people we know can get in power, and even if they can't, we will privately do this through our own tactics. I know that's a tall order, but I think you're going to see it. So that's my big claim for the future.
Okay. I love to dream.
Curing the obesity epidemic. Don't dream, Katie. You're going to be the one serving the meal. So with us.
I'll be writing it up for the New York Times, honey. No, I don't mind serving a meal.
Awesome.
That's
all
my
right,
fast
guys.
Life. Are you going now?
Luck.
Well, happy.
Happy, yeah. Well, I'll call you before, but and I'll see all
safe
you guys.
Safe travels. I'm taking off on Tuesday, so I certainly
you're going to Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And are you going to? When are you going to announce the launch of your culinary school?
I guess that'll be sometime in January. We hope.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Awesome.
We'll keep you posted.
So, Erica, have fun, and Jack, and Nat, thanks.
Thank you.
I'll see you guys in 2010.
Safe travels.
Okay,
Patrick.
Baby. Bye.
Bye.
Happy New Year.
And Vixen, Comet, and Cupid, and Donna, and Blitzen.
we're back. It's the main course on Heritage Radio Network, and this week we are sponsored by the Hearst Ranch. In the engineering booth, we have Jack Inslee as our producer and Nat Wiener as our engineer. Thank you, guys. And in the studio with me, I have the wonderful Erica Demain.
Hi, Katie.
Cookbook author extraordinaire and with a fantastic blog that everyone should be tuning into on at least once a week basis, www.ericademain.com. And that's E-R-I-C-A-D-E-M-A-N-E. .com. Check it out. So I asked Erica to come back. She's a second time guest, and we wanted to talk a little bit about Christmas, traditional Christmas foods, and sort of how the Italians celebrate Christmas Eve in particular, which has always been the day that we've celebrated because Christmas was reserved for hangover food. So do you want to talk a little, because the Italians have a very elaborate feast kind of presentation. And then later on, after we go through that stuff, then we'll call Gina De Palma from Babbo, and she can tell us a little bit about traditional Italian desserts for the same. So go for it, Erica.
La Vigilia, which is Christmas Eve, means the vigil.
Yes.
And it's traditionally a huge fish dinner. In this country, Italian Americans usually do 7 fish courses, and that's the
tradition.
That's
kind of mind blowing.
I think it stands for the 7 sacraments, I believe.
What are the 7 sacraments?
Don't ask me,
guys. Do you know anybody? Any churchgoers out there?
Sleepy, dopey.
As a former Catholic,
maybe Gina will know.
It's actually baptism, Eucharist, reconciliation, confirmation, marriage, holy orders, and anointing of the sick.
Oh. Way to go, Jack!
Very good.
Oh, he's so quick.
That's very nice. I'm glad he knew that. He looked it up.
Yeah, Jack's fast.
But one of the things about this fish dinner is that a lot of people in this country have, a lot of Italian Americans have sort of decided the hell with it. And as a child, this was my favorite meal of the whole year. And I looked forward to this.
And that's because you love fish so much?
I love fish. But I also loved a lot of things about it. First of all, it was eaten late at night, later than usual dinner. Usually we had it around 10. And as a kid, that was highly exciting.
And very sexy.
Very sexy. Absolutely. Candles. I mean, you know, it was just a thing that felt really grown up and really fabulous. And also the fish aspect. And I also loved the ceremony of bringing, you know, one dish out at a time and then the next dish. I love that. That's one thing that's so great about Italian cooking in general, is that they don't just, it's never just like a big slop of food that's thrown on the table, where we do get this in America a lot.
Yes.
Italians will bring out, you know, a meat course, and you'll get just meat on the plate.
Yeah.
And then you'll get a vegetable course, and it will just be a vegetable, and it'll come later. And I just think that's really an amazing thing. It's a hell of a lot of work, obviously, for the cook. But, you know, I mean, that's one of the reasons why a thing like this in this country is really gone down the tubes. And but not for me.
Not for Erica. No.
But the thing is, it's really changed the way I've done it because, you know, when I was a kid, we never did 7 dishes because that was really a lot to get out of the kitchen. But we would do 4, 5.
Start, so like what?
Oh my God.
So would you start with clams on the half shell or shrimp?
Sometimes oysters. Sometimes my mother would buy caviar, which is not exactly, you know, it was just her take on it.
Yeah.
And then we would have usually like a cold, some kind of cold seafood salad, usually had calamari in it or scongili, which my father and I loved, the only people who loved it. And then oftentimes it was a pattern, you know, a lot of times it was the same things. Linguine with clam sauce, with white wine, lemon, parsley, garlic, you know.
Yum.
Very, very clean beauty. Oftentimes like shrimp scampi, you know, Shrimp.
Shrimp scampi. Isn't scampi shrimp?
Exactly.
I've always wanted to like yes. make sure that that yeah. was right.
Well, scampi are the big long...
They're the big ones. And then what, right. you roast them with garlic and butter and well, my garlic
my,
and olive oil?
My mother used to try to get the ones in the big ones in the shell as best she could. And she would split them down the back with the shells on and then stuff garlic and parsley and breadcrumbs and stuff. And I... And olive oil and wine. And I think she used to actually just throw them in the broiler, mm-hmm. like real quick. Mm-hmm. And they were really, really like a high-octane, intense garlic mass. And it's really delicious. And we'd always have Prosecco. And, I mean, it was just such an amazing thing. I mean, you know, then when I started doing my own Christmas Eve dinners at my house, when I became an adult... I can't remember if that when that happened.
When was that?
I don't know. I'm not sure if it actually it did yeah. actually in fact happen yet.
Yeah, I was going to say,
At some point, I did have my own home, and, yes. and that's when it started.
More to the point.
Right. So at first, I started, you know, trying to do sort of what we did as a child and doing a lot of the same dishes. We always had this strange dish that I always hated that's a Neapolitan dish that's called... Insalata rinforza, which is a cold cauliflower with it's a big traditional dish in
that could be good. Like yeah, with vinaigrette on it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it had roasted peppers and olives and
that
capers.
Delicious.
I hated it.
Why?
And I don't know.
You would so like that now.
Yeah, I don't know. I found it sour tasting, but so I dropped that immediately. Even though that is a very traditional thing, it's still done in Naples a lot. And so I started making different things. I mean, I made, I love salt cod, which is another very, very traditional.
Yeah, every country has its own version of bacalao,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. And it's especially a traditional element for Christmas Eve in southern Italy. Mm-hmm. And usually it's made with, you know, stewed with tomatoes and olives and white wine. And it's really lovely. But I decided I wanted to do a Venetian version, which is very much like a Provençal brandade, which is more of a pureed dish
oh.
that's baked. It's made with a lot of garlic and olive oil. And in Italian, it's
called...
So you
soak the salt fish and then you puree it in the blender?
You poach it. And then you do it either in a Cuisinart or by hand. And you beat olive oil into it. You can add potato. You can add a lot of garlic. I add lemon. I add other things. I add lemon zest. I add some thyme. In Venice, the dish is called bacalà mantecato, which means to pounded, yeah. And even though I am a Southern Italian cook, I've decided that that's become a tradition in my family now for Christmas Eve. And I make it every year, and I love it.
It sounds, even for me, who despises fish
in
almost every description.
You would like this. I'll tell you, what I do is, after I make the mush, and it is a mush,
yeah.
You spread it out into a baking dish and you top it with breadcrumbs and olive oil and herbs and then olives,
yeah.
good black olives, and then you just run it under the broiler so it gets really crispy on top and you serve it on, you know, garlic toasts or...
Oh
my God, it's just the best.
That sounds kind of nice. You don't put any potato in yours? Because I think in France, brandade morue is
yes,
with potato and olive oil,
Yes. In Italy, it's often done without potato. I like it with a little bit of potato.
Mm-hmm.
Because I
would too, because then I would feel like
it cuts the salt cod taste.
Yeah,
yeah. But just a little bit. I don't want it to be. I don't want it to taste like a big dish of mashed potatoes. But it is like
See, that would work for me.
Yeah, hold the salt cod for me.
Yeah,
yeah.
Put everything else in though.
But I always make that. And what other traditions? I mean, I've made my own traditions. I always have mussels that have been baked and stuffed. With something, you know, breadcrumbs and herbs and, you know, run under the broil. Like classic baked clams of Mulberry Street.
Right.
But these are a hell of a lot better. And
well, what interested me, I mean, the last time you came on, and this is kind of a perfect point to introduce the idea of what is authentic, what is traditional,
right.
and the fact that these things are always an evolving process. It's not just, you can't just eat one thing for the, you know, next 200 years. It's always going to end up turning into something new.
It's interesting because that's true in general for Italian food. It's less true in Italy for holidays. People tend to want...
They really do stick
they
to
They really the... stick to what the grandmother made, what the, you know, great-grandmother made, and people expect it and are really disappointed if it doesn't show up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like, for instance, I mean, in Italy, 13 dishes are... more traditional than Italian Americans usually do the seven
sacraments. When do you have time to go to mass at midnight though if you eat 13 courses?
Oh, you start this, it takes hours. I mean,
you start in the afternoon.
Yeah, and also the idea of Christmas midnight mass is kind of, I think, started during World War II. I don't believe it actually really existed before that. So it's kind of, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, relatively a new tradition, yeah. But I mean, in Naples, I mean, what they comes to the table is like mind boggling. I mean, you'll start out with eel, you'll have calamari, you'll have braised octopus. I mean, escarole torta, which is another traditional thing, which I still make sometimes.
Yes.
I mean, you'll have oysters, you'll have everything, you know, sardines, pasta, lobster, I mean, every single kind of sea urchins, any kind of gruesome sea creature that you would love to...
Sea bugs.
Yeah, sea bugs, all sorts of things like that. And
unfortunately, lobsters became sea bugs for me when I was pregnant.
Oh, that's so sad.
I've never really gotten over it.
I just love them. But eel is one of the creepiest things to have to make because eel has to be cooked... has to be skinned alive.
No.
Yes.
Why?
Because it's got to be really, really fresh.
Why can't you blanch it after it's dead and peel it like a fruit?
You can, but, you know, the tradition is that...
Oh, that's gruesome,
okay,
America.
Okay, but let me just tell you something.
How do you do it, though?
Okay, I know exactly how to do this because when I worked at... I worked at a restaurant called Le Madre for many years. It was one of Pino Longo's...
Yeah, it was on 18th Street. Yeah. I remember it well.
It was a wonderful restaurant. And at one point, I don't remember whether it was during Christmas or not, but we got eels in. And they came in live, squirming in a big goddamn burlap sack.
Ew!
Yes. And
did they bite? They must have been biting.
I don't know. You know, I so didn't really want to deal with this, but this was one of my jobs. Mm. So I said to the chef at the time, and I said, can we sort of like kill them first? And he said, well, you don't really kill them, but what you can do is you could sort of like knock them out a little bit. So what he did, he dumped all these eels into this big, into the sink and covered them with water and red wine vinegar. And what... This was such a depressing, sad little story.
Whoa.
They got what happened was that they just sort of got groggy and miserable. And at this point, they weren't quite dead, but they were sort of dead.
Yeah.
Or they were just drunk on vinegar.
Wow.
Or something. And then Alan Tardy was the name of the chef at the time, a really fine chef who went on to work for Slow Food in Bologna, I believe, and is still doing that. And then he took the things and he showed me how to open their mouths, hammer the open mouth to a board and rip
with a nail.
With a nail, and then take a knife and rip around right under the mouth.
Yeah.
And then rip the skin down.
Oh, man.
While these things were sort of, you know.
Did they wriggle when you did that?
Yes, they did.
So that means it hurt.
I'm telling you, this was not a good day. For me,
no.
Luckily,
I would have had to take some tranquilizers.
It only happened once, and then it was just. I guess Alan figured it was just too much work, and why are we doing this?
And Americans aren't going to buy eels.
And I actually,
unless they're from the South.
The truth is, I went into the bathroom and I cried for about 20 minutes.
Oh yeah,
this. I really did.
I feel like crying just hearing the story.
I burst into tears. Although I love eel, and then we grilled them.
Uh-huh.
You know, cut them into pieces, and that's usually how it's done in southern Italy. Grilled eel is one of the most delicious things. It's usually marinated first, in oil and wine and herbs, and then thrown on the grill. It's fabulous. It
really
is.
You know, my father was a great fan of eel. He grew up in New Orleans.
Oh,
yeah, and
right.
I think in the South they must have done a lot of eel too, or at least in the Louisiana.
From what tradition? From Sicilian? Because there's so many Sicilians.
Perhaps.
Maybe.
I mean, he was like half Jew, half whatever.
Yeah.
But that's what they did. Was they eel was a regular part of the menu, and I think they must have been able to catch them. They must have been freshwater eels,
yeah.
And they probably grew in Lake Pontchartrain when you could still actually fish there. Because the other thing that they used to do a lot was fish for crawdads there, and have these big crayfish boils.
So what did they? How did they present the eel?
I don't know. He never told me. He never described doing that. And
it's just a craziness. I think that they at Alan
I
wanted.
Think they
to,
just chopped him up and cooked him.
Yeah. Well, I think he wanted to do it the traditional way, and he wanted to freak me out. So,
yes,
you know,
the macho thing in the kitchen.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. You
I'm
know,
so familiar with
the little girl, you know.
Yeah, the little
and
girl
I did,
you
and,
can't handle.
And I cried. He got his wish, you know.
Well, they did that to me when I was working in France, and they were like, you know, making me like eviscerate game birds and
skin
rabbits and stuff.
I had to skin rabbits.
Yeah. And,
oh, my God.
Yes, and haunches of venison.
Oh, my God.
And,
that
yes.
was so sad. That was.
I didn't mind that so much,
really?
Actually. Oh, yeah.
God.
Well, they were dead already.
They were
dead. So we'd get a box full of bunnies, dead bunnies.
Dead bunnies, sure.
And then we'd
skin them.
And then
down.
We'd have to skin them and.
Oh, but the little paws, the little fuzzy paws.
I didn't enjoy cutting the feet off,
oh,
I have to
God.
Admit. But, you know, these things, I mean, somehow you get, when you're working with food like that all the time,
you get used to
you
it.
You get used. It's like, it seems natural. I mean, we all sort of go, ooh, ew, ew. But I think we're also accustomed to the styrofoam packaging of our food.
That's right.
That the connection to an actual living and breathing beast is sort of lost there. And we've discussed that ad nauseum here. But
well, actually, that reminds me of another really, really big, big time Christmas Eve dish that I've been making a lot. And this was a dish that came from my grandfather. But I never met him. He died very young, but he was Sicilian. And he made this dish that was a pasta with lobster and brandy and tomatoes.
Oh, I've had that.
And it was. But he made it every year for Christmas Eve.
That's very good.
I never tasted his version, but I recreated the dish from my mother's memory of
yeah.
it. And that dish is made by hacking up live lobsters.
I have done that, too.
Which is also something I used to have to do in restaurants. They'd come in crates of them.
Yeah.
You know, you'd have to hack up, you know, there is
a science to that, though, because you stick the knife into the brain and you break it down.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're going to grill a lobster outside, you have to do that, too.
Right.
You got to split them in half.
Right. So I got used. I'm pretty used to doing that. And I still make. This year, I'm not doing that dish, but last year I did. And and you know, I hack them up live. I was happy to do it.
I can be sanguine about fish.
Yeah,
it's the mammals that bother me.
Yeah, it's true.
Although that eel story is still haunting me. Well, let's take a quick break and go to Gina De Palma from Babbo, and then we'll talk about desserts, pastry making, and everything.
One thing. I made a pignoli nut tart from her book. Last year, I believe, for Christmas Eve, and it was fabulous.
Well, you'll have to tell her when she comes on. So let's take a break and go to Gina next.
Okay.
I ain't talking just to tease people like you that don't grow on trees. Look at you, that's what it's gonna be. Have everything I need around my sober Christmas tree. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, I love you, have good cheer. I love you, good dog, got my baby, my best love. Happiness, good God, I got plenty of.
And we are back on the main course. This is Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting from the back of Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick at 261 Moore Street. And in the studio with me is Erica Demain. And on the phone with me is the wonderful Gina De Palma, one of the best pastry chefs in America today. And Gina, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm snowed in, but I'm okay.
That's cool. Erica, before the break, I don't know if you heard, but Erica was just yodeling the praises of your pinoli nut tart, which she had made a couple of years ago.
Last Christmas Eve, I made it, and it was really, really, really good.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah,
definitely.
It's great. I mean, I've always had them, and I've never actually just made them because I don't do a lot of sweet baking. I'm really not a sweets person. I do a lot of savory baking, but mm-hmm. I just needed to.
We prefer to use our calories up in alcohol yeah. instead of in sweets.
That's for sure.
Alcohol, carbs, those are all very worthy uses of the yeah. caloric unit.
Right. That's right. Gina, so tell us a little bit about what's on the menu for Christmas desserts at Babbo, and what do you think of as, like, we were talking about what's traditional in Italian families for Christmas treats. What's traditional for you guys?
Well, right now, I have actually the cranberry tart that's in my book on our menu because I just love red at Christmas time, more so than the red and green thing. I just love red. So I've got that on, and that's kind of nice, a nice pop of color on the menu. And then we're also making castagnaccio, which is like a chestnut cake.
I love that.
Which is actually from the Babbo cookbook. I gave that recipe to Mario for the Babbo cookbook years and years ago, and it's definitely one of my favorites. It's funny how things have changed. I can serve that now, and people aren't freaked out by it.
Well,
when we first opened, people were like, what? Chestnut flour? I don't like that. And it didn't really go over very well. And now people are just kind of scarfing it down. So I'm really happy about that.
Well, it's interesting because that dish is not sweet, right?
Well, it is. Mine is.
Oh,
I make a very amped up sweet version of that.
Oh, okay. Because I've only had it without sugar. And
yeah.
I like that. I like it without sugar. But I think I'd like it better with sugar.
Yeah, I kind of amp it up a little bit with sugar and a little bit of fruit, but I keep the walnuts and the pine nuts and the rosemary
right.
in there as well.
Nice.
To kind of keep with the traditional.
Lovely, yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
You know, chestnut flour has that little bitter tinge to it, I think, and if you don't, I'm trying to, you know, please a wide range of palates, so unfortunately sugar winds up being the answer, but it really works. I think all the flavors work really well together, and it kind of winds up being like a sweet, chestnutty version of fruitcake, almost.
Do Italians use a lot of chestnuts in baking traditionally? Is that, I don't know, you know.
Well, Italians use chestnuts. Have always had a lot of chestnut desserts and chestnut preparations because in lean times, you know, chestnuts grow all over Italy from the top to the bottom, even in Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
When they couldn't get grain, which was quite often, they went to the chestnut forest and they made bread with. I mean, it wasn't very pleasant because chestnut isn't a grain, so it
right.
doesn't wind up resulting in a product that has, you know, the texture of bread. But when you needed to survive, they're quite nutritious.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, for long periods of time, if they needed to live on chestnuts, they lived on chestnuts.
Well, you know, there are other cultures that lived on acorns, and we never think of those as a particularly, and in fact, they're very difficult to process because they are extremely bitter and require, I think Indians in California would like soak them in the river for like 3 days to get the bitterness out, and there were other methods of treating them. But Bolano culture was very big all around the world, so I'm not surprised that chestnuts being plentiful in Italy would provide the same nutritious.
Absolutely. I mean, they do wonderful candied chestnuts, just like the Marron Glacé in France, but it's their own, it's my phone, their own version of it, which is wonderful. There's chestnut candies, there's, you know, chestnut pasta, chestnut crepes, things like that.
Ooh,
definitely,
pasta.
It is a.
I've made chestnut.
A fall thing.
I've made chestnut pasta. It's difficult. It gets a little crumbly. You need to.
You need flour. You need to mix it with bread flour.
Exactly.
And that's how it works.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And you have to put a little gluten. It's got to be glutened up. Yeah, but it's delicious.
Absolutely.
What do you sauce that with?
Mushrooms and anchovies.
Mushrooms, definitely. That's what we've done at Babbo, mushroom preparation. Or even like a boar, something hearty, like a boar ragu.
Ooh,
or,
yum.
You know, like a chestnut pappardelle with boar ragu. Mm. Delicious.
That sounds really good, Gina.
Yeah.
So Gina, aren't you making those struffoli over at Bobo for Christmas or what?
You know what? My mom and I just made struffoli this morning.
No way.
Oh, that's so great.
We did. My mom was in the mood for rolling out struffoli, and it's perfect two-person job.
Right.
So, I do try to make a plate of them every year.
Yeah.
At
what
Bobo
are they?
And put it out. And it's always interesting to see who recognizes it and who doesn't. You know, in the dining room, who might say, "Oh my goodness, is that a big tower of struffoli over there?"
Tell Katie. Katie doesn't know what it is. Tell her.
I'd be one of those people.
Yeah, she doesn't know.
They're just little balls of dough that are fried,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and you coat them in honey.
Oh, and then you stick them together?
Well, you don't stick them together. You just kind of pile them up on a plate, and they wind up getting kind of stuck together. I have a few tricks that I do to keep them from being so hard, because if you boil honey, you evaporate some of the water out of it that's in there naturally, and it kind of gets really hard. So I add a little splash of sweet wine, like Vinsanto or Pasito or something like that, to it to kind of keep it a little loose and keep them moist.
Mm-hmm.
That recipe's in my book too, but they're just definitely for me a big childhood thing. I took struffoli to school in third grade for show and tell.
Oh, that must have been embarrassing for everybody.
Well, yeah, I was the only Italian kid for miles and acres.
Is that right?
Oh, really?
Where'd you grow up, Gina?
I grew up in Virginia.
Oh,
I grew up in Northern Virginia. So, yeah, I was definitely one of the weird ethnic kids.
Oh, yeah. That's like being a Jew. I mean, forget about it.
I don't even think we had any WASPs in our high school where I went.
Really?
You mean it was all Italian?
It was all Italians and Jews and Jews.
Long Island.
Long Island, yeah. Nassau County.
There you go.
There you go.
Long Island.
Yeah.
So I took struffoli to school for show and tell, which was really, really did not go over as well as I'd hoped.
But it's so delicious. They must have loved it.
Yeah. I mean, it's who doesn't love something fried? And Italians
and
love
honey.
To celebrate the holidays with fried things. You know, Carnivale is all about fried things, too. So
what else is like Erica was describing the 7 and the 13, you know, fish dishes that are traditional for the night before Christmas. Are there specific desserts that are part of that panoply of goodness, or does that come later on in the sort of Christmas season?
Well, I don't know that there's like a traditional dessert that's part of that feast, but, Italians are always into, the pasticcini, the little pastries. So it's very traditional to have an assortment of that. It depends on where you are. In Tuscany, of course, there's going to be panforte.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
Yeah, and, in especially in the north, but I correct myself. In every region, there's a holiday festival bread. There's a Christmas bread. So panettone, which has kind of become more of a national thing, originated in Milan.
Yeah.
And pandoro is from the Veneto. And, there's a Christmas bread, a pinza friulana or gubana in Friuli. There's a Christmas bread kind of in every region that they make. So that's usually always present.
We always
go ahead.
We always had pizza rustica on Christmas Day, which actually,
that's an Easter thing.
Is traditionally an Easter thing, but for some reason in our family it became a Christmas thing.
Well, maybe because you had a hangover.
Yes, everybody in my
so often is in Italian American families, though, because you kind of just want to do it whenever you want to do it.
Well, I think I think in general it's very funny about Italian holiday dishes when they came to this country from Italy. A lot of them became sort of these sort of like pan holiday dishes.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, like ricotta, like the pastiera, ricotta cheesecake with the wheat berries.
That's definitely Easter Neapolitan. Yeah.
And then that starts showing up in bakeries around Christmas also sometimes. And, they just throw everything out.
Well, I think that's a very American thing.
Exactly. That's what I meant.
I think because in America, we want when we want it, when we want it, and we don't want to hear nothing about it.
Yeah.
So, whereas, I think that we are a bit indulgent in that way. Whereas in Italy, they're more observant of the tradition and the reason. Right. Besides Christmas and Easter and Carnivale, I would say the other celebration time in any Italian city is the feast day. And, of course, the feast days are different for every city, for every saint. You know, there's a patron saint of every village or city or town, and that saint's feast day is another time that you celebrate. So there are traditional foods that happen at all of those times, and it's almost unthinkable to kind of cart those foods out at a different time because...
Right.
These are very, you know, you look forward to these things.
Well,
and there's just something more special about having them when you're supposed to have them. And I think that Italians recognize that. And in, like, you know, we in America, we just, you know, we want it. We're the instant gratification.
Well,
culture,
that's funny you should mention that because St. Lucy's Day was just, I believe, December 13th.
Absolutely, 13th. Catania. She's the
right.
patron saint of Catania.
Yeah, she's the one with the eyeballs on the plate.
The breasts. Those are breasts, my dear.
That's
St. Agatha.
St. Agatha's
the breast.
Right, that's
yeah.
St. Agatha.
Yeah,
St. Lucy. Yeah, you're right, the eyeballs.
But
mm-hmm.
but in Sicily, they serve cuccia for St. Lucy's Day. It's a tradition, which is boiled wheat berries.
Absolutely. Mixed, it's like a custard.
Mixed with ricotta and cinnamon. And
it's delicious.
Yeah,
that sounds good.
Yeah, it's good. It's
well,
really
actually,
good.
Gina, we're going to have... Erica has a really close friend who's written many books about the saints, and they have a project going together now where Erica develops menus for the saints' days, sort of based on historical research, and this all goes up on a website of Barbara... What's Barbara's last
Calamari,
name?
Calamari.
Barbara Calamari,
yes.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. So we'll have to shoot you the link to that because I think you'll get
absolutely.
A kick out of it.
Absolutely, I'd love to see that. I have three or four books of different feast days and information on you know all the. I try to get comprehensive on all the places in Italy that I travel, so that you know if I just happen to be around, I always look up. Okay, it's November, I'm in Italy, who's having a feast day?
Yeah,
and try and go check it out, because you learn so much about the local culture by doing that.
Oh, I've loved doing this. I write a monthly column for her, for Novena.com called Dining with the Saints.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Novena.com.
Yeah.
And Barbara Calamari has...
I have a great book called At the Table with the Saints.
I have that book, too.
A Tavolo con I Santi. Yeah.
Great
book.
Great book.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Oh, my God.
We're probably the only two people
in America
who have that book.
Well, you'll
Without
have to come out, Gina, when the weather is better, you'll come to the studio with Erica and we'll do a whole thing about that. Because I think that would be a really interesting hour of radio with Barbara.
It would be great.
Just talk about sort of how all those traditions evolve and what we bring into the current century and what we leave behind.
I would love to. I just got back from, I was in Calabria where my family is from. Mm. And I, you know, kind of got a good dousing of that tradition there. So I'd love to come in and talk about that because I could definitely go on for hours.
Yeah.
Well, you know, actually, Gina, can I ask you, there's a, my family is part Sicilian, part Puglian. And,
okay.
And I remember for Christmas, Christmas Day, my father used to buy these... rosette wheel. They're much like a strufle. I think that might be called
carta date.
Yes.
And they look kind of like ribbons.
Yes.
Of dough that they wind around in a spiral.
Right.
And then douse in honey. And sometimes there's like raisins and almonds on there.
And
too.
I think I remember them being also drizzled with a vincotto.
I was just going to say grape must.
Grape must,
yeah,
yes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Those
yep.
are really delicious.
Those are really good. Those are really good. And actually, I'm doing a recipe for that in my next book.
Oh,
so
excellent.
Hopefully I'll have something.
Oh, I want a recipe for that because you don't see them around in bakery shops here anymore.
No, you don't. You don't. Those things are becoming so localized.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that worries me sometimes when I'm over in Italy is that they do kind of pick up, they take a lot of cues from America. And whenever I see things that are either disappearing or kind of around at the wrong time of year, it does kind of concern me that mm-hmm. we're influencing their culture a little bit too much because I very much want to see these things continue. And I think what we do now, even on such a small level, even what we do now by talking about these things is so important.
Oh,
because
I agree.
I think that, you know, the whatever you want to say about the foodie movement here, that's what's going to keep these traditions alive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You
know, exactly.
Otherwise, we'll just descend into a McDonald's-fueled, you know, abyss. I mean...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It is really important to keep those, whatever mm-hmm. the tradition is that you come from. It's, you know, whether it's lutefisk or, you know, or, you know, roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. I mean, that's your stuff. And
absolutely.
There are days when you're supposed to eat that and days when, you know, you can just give it a pass.
You know, I have to say, I do experiment with different Christmas Eve fish dishes every year because I get bored and I want to do different things, and but it's still fish, and it's still Italian.
And you know, that's what's fun, is to do a new thing every year, to kind of keep your lineup of old classics right. and do something new as well. You know, my family used to get together for that dinner every year too. You know, it's so bad when everything gets scattered and people get too busy and these things kind of start to die out, because those are definitely some of my fondest memories of childhood
too.
Is having, you know, that big dinner.
Well, so many people write to me on they have been for the last month or so on my website saying, you know, my family doesn't do the fish dinner anymore. They don't make the cookies anymore. Mm-hmm. I have get so many, you're the one who should really be getting these comments, but I get so many requests for Italian Christmas cookies, lost Christmas cookies.
I get a lot of emails about lost Christmas cookies.
Oh my God.
And like, they're very, you have to really become a detective to figure it out, because some of these things are town to town. They're literally... done in one town, and 7 miles down the road, they're not done at all.
That's
and if
right.
somebody's grandmother came from that town, and that cookie loomed really large in their life, and that's not being done anymore, it really is hard to kind of track it down.
Yeah.
And then there are the things that where from town, it's the same cookie, but from town to town, it's called something completely different.
Yes, and from family to family.
Absolutely. It becomes really difficult.
No.
I my heart goes out to these people. I try my best. I think I have a lot of luck on digging
well, you,
this stuff
you
up.
Well, you probably, you know, obviously do a much, much better job than I do. But, I mean, I find these the Italian Christmas cookie requests like the torment of my life this time of year.
Well,
I mean,
now you know where to send them.
Yeah. Can I send them all over to you?
You can. Absolutely.
Are you serious?
Absolutely. I've got a little team of friends over there.
You're not going to hate me for it?
No. You know, I have a team of friends over there who when I need to shoot them a question, I do. I have my little secret sleuths over on site.
Oh, that's great.
In country.
Yeah.
Deep cover in country.
Yeah, that's great.
Who kind of helped me out with those questions. Yeah.
Well, girls, we're going to have to wrap this up. Gina, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm looking forward to welcoming you back into the studio when you are,
definitely.
So snowed in. And also, when is your next book coming out? You're still in the process.
When I finish writing it.
Yeah, okay. So it's not something we can announce as imminent.
No, not yet, but as soon as I get a manuscript in and I get an idea of when they're going to put it in the rotation to get it published, I will let you know.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Well, we will promote it like mad. So, Erica, thanks so much for coming out.
You're so welcome.
And Gina,
nice
thank you so much
you,
for joining
oh,
us.
Oh, you too.
Merry Christmas,
Merry
my
Christmas.
Dear.
Merry Christmas.
Let's
One
hope
Natale.
2010
okay.
is our best year ever. And we'll be back in a few minutes with Divya Gugnani. And we are back. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. My cohort and co-host, Patrick Martins, was on earlier in the show, but he's out in Chicago doing the Saxelby dance. So he'll be back after the first of the year. We will broadcast again on January 3rd, I believe. Anyway, we are sponsored today by Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. That's 261 Moore Street. By the way, they're promoting a fantastic looking new Christmas Eve menu. I strongly recommend checking it out. I'm sure it's posted on their website, and the food is always delicious at Roberta's. So we have Divya Gugnani. Am I saying that right, Divya?
You are.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm sorry that we couldn't have you in the studio, but I totally understand not wanting to drive.
In this weather with this much snow.
Where are you coming from? Where would you have come
just
from?
Just Manhattan, not far away.
Uh-huh.
Just lots of snow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I loved the silence of the city this morning. When I woke up, it was like heaven. It was, you know, you could either think of it as apocalyptic or you could think of it as heaven. And
you can realize that how many crazy New Yorkers went out for dinner last night. I went out for dinner last night and the restaurant was packed.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I thought it was beautiful out last night. I loved it. The snow was like pelting down. My kid and I went out and, you know, with some friends of hers and schlepped down to 101st Street. It was glorious.
It was our first storm, so it was mm-hmm. a lot of fun.
It was our first storm, and I don't think we got any snow last year. So it was like, you know, it's supposed to snow at this time of year.
It
Talk
is.
To me in 2 weeks. I'll be done with it. But right now it looks really good.
It does.
So Divya, tell us about Behind the Burner, which is your website. And, you know, how'd you get this started? I mean, you have an incredible roster of chefs participating. Why don't you give listeners an idea of what they can find on there? And then you can tell us a little bit about how you got it going.
So Behind the Burner is an emerging culinary media brand. We focus on content, and it's all expert-based content, in four areas: food, wine, mixology, and nutrition. We're really aimed and catered to a younger generation of food, beverage, wine, and nutrition enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. We feel like a lot of the content that's out there is written for a very specific demo, and there's a lot of people who, you know, really like to dine out, are just starting to cook, are just starting to enjoy fine wine, and this is kind of their first experience with it, so we're just kind of navigating them through the process. So we do expert-based content. We have a network of over 325 experts.
Wow.
And the experts fall in those four areas I mentioned: food, wine, mixology, and beverage.
Right.
So they involve celebrity chefs like Wolfgang Puck and Michael Mina and Marcus Samuelson, Todd English, people like that.
Uh-huh.
But also winemakers, sommeliers, mixologists, and nutritionists.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically take their best tips, tricks, and techniques, and we package those in the form of videos, articles, and blogs. Our videos, which can be found on BehindTheBurner.com, are also broadcast to TV through NBC New York Nonstop, so we're
okay.
on there every day pretty much, about every 4 to 8 hours for 3 to 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
We do some syndication to Channel 4 NBC Local as well.
Wonderful.
And 49 online media properties, including most recently, BravoTV.com.
That's great. Wow, Divya, you're obviously a dynamo.
So we're busy with that.
This is your brainchild, right?
Yeah, it is. And we're really just trying to touch this audience, build brand, and build awareness with them across all forms of media. So the broadcast TV piece, the online piece, both on our site and the syndicated properties, and then also with print. I just wrote my first book that's going to be published by HarperCollins.
Congratulations.
And we have an iTunes podcast as well. So,
uh-huh. What's your book?
It's called Food Slut, My Little Black Book of Tips from Behind the Burner, a no-nonsense guide to staying slim, fit, and fabulous for women who live to eat.
Uh-huh.
And that's okay. what I do. I live
Bring
to eat.
Bring it on, girl.
Exactly. Not about diets, about eating, enjoying food, enjoying the experience.
Absolutely. So I'm guessing your background is marketing, though, just from the way you talk. So
no.
How'd you get into this?
Surprisingly enough, my background is finance, as boring as that could be.
Ah, well, no wonder you got into food.
Exactly, right? They're a happy marriage, I think. When you have a nice expense account, you can enjoy good food.
That's right.
So I started my career in Goldman Sachs. I was an investment banking there. And I went to culinary school nights and weekends at the French Culinary Institute.
Cool.
Got my degree, had a tremendous passion for culinary arts, really wanted to learn how to cook well,
mm-hmm.
and continued to cook while I had a career in finance. So I was most recently a technology venture capitalist at Firstmark Capital. We had about $2 billion under management. And I oversaw our investments in all the quantitative, non-sexy things like health services, insurance technology.
I think that's very sexy.
Financial services.
What are you talking about, girl?
And then jumped off into the world of food because I just had a real desire and passion to reach out to all the people who changed the way I thought about food and beverage,
uh-huh.
and to really share that knowledge with, you know, the world.
So how did you get this website started? I mean, what was your first, like, you had the vision, right?
Yeah, had this aha moment, basically, is what mm-hmm. happened. I had, you know, this career in finance, was very happy, had really worked with lots of startups in terms of the beginning stage of building their company, growing it, and then selling it. So I'd seen all stages of business, but I'd never actually done it for myself. And I had passion for all things culinary. So one day I'm at Cipriani on Sunday night before, you know, they have karaoke, Cipriani downtown.
You just made that up.
You know, I swear. And so I'm like, you know, Sunday night at Cipriani when they do karaoke upstairs at the club. And I'm out with my friends. I'm like, wouldn't it be fun if I reached out to all the chefs I knew, you know, all the bartenders and all these people, and I basically got all their best tips, and I packaged them up and kind of shared them with the world. They're like, you're crazy. You have a career in finance. Go back to work on Monday and forget about what you just said.
Right.
And I said, no, I really want to do it. So I did it. I just, you know, started the company, and I had a full-time job, so it was really a toe in the water. I didn't go full force. And then I raised a small angel finance round and, you know, had some capital to get the company off the ground.
Yeah, because you have a very slick-looking website. I mean, this is not a mom-and-pop item here. This
no,
is like,
it's not.
You got it. It really was like, wow, this is like almost too groovy for the likes of us at Heritage Radio Network. I mean, you should see where we are, where I am right now. I mean, I don't know if you realize that I'm broadcasting from a shipping container.
Yes, I know, I know. I was looking forward to coming and visiting.
Well, you'll have to come another time.
I will.
Actually, this
love
is a really fun and interesting conversation. I mean, I have had a few bloggers on in the past, you know, people with successful blogs, and that's sort of a thread that I'd like to keep exploring. So maybe we can have like a little round table with you and Andrea Strong and, you know, my friend Erica or Regina Schrambling or somebody like
that.
Yeah,
I would love to.
That'd be kind of cool, yeah.
You know, and the best part of this is not only just following my passion and doing something that I really love, but also the people I've met. It's just been the world of food and wine is just a really wonderful, warm world of generous people who, you know, want to share their experiences.
Yeah, I think that's true, too. That's what drew me to cooking in the first place. That and the fact that I could always get a job no matter where I was.
Exactly. You know? Recession proof.
Yeah, like totally.
Only better because you get to eat.
Yeah, exactly. Well, since I didn't have a head for finance, I had to do something, right?
You know, it's been really fun. It's just, you know, it's as a venture capitalist, I spent a lot of time on the sidelines kind of watching people and coaching them. Mm-hmm. But it's been a real transformational experience to kind of jump over to entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And, you know, to do it yourself.
Well, do you have a lot of corporate sponsors there? I can't remember right now offhand. When I looked at your website, it was so content rich that I sort of like skipped over the part of like, you know, how you actually support it. But how do you make a website like this work for you financially?
So we basically do branded integrations. We work with brands to create some advertorial content. A vast majority of our content is editorial. So it's completely our lens and extracting really valuable information from all these experts in a very bite-sized, easy to digest form.
Uh-huh.
But we do work with some brands. So, for example, Bacardi, Remy Martin, some emerging spirits, wine, restaurants, and, you know, cookware, gourmet food type brands, and we basically address the finer points of what they're doing, given an expert lens. Like, for example, we'd work with a liquor brand and, you know, feature their liquor in a clip, but it'll be a brand master talking about why it's so different, what the best tips are for using it, making some great cocktails with it. We give it that kind of advertorial lens. It's valuable to the consumer. They get something out of it, but it's actually branded. And, you know, we're very specific in showing, you know, this is sponsored by or this is, you know, very clear so that there's a delineation between what we're doing editorially.
Right. Right. And that provides enough financial,
you know, does. I mean,
engine for you to keep on running and keep developing.
It does,
more.
But we, you know, we've got it. We have multiple sources of revenue. We do branded integration. We do product placements in some of our clips, which are also clearly delineated.
Uh-huh.
And then we do commerce. You can buy tools and ingredients at a discount on our site.
Yeah.
You can actually, you know, use coupon codes and buy them on other sites, and, you know, save money while shopping and buying really fine quality stuff that we actually recommend.
Uh-huh. Fantastic.
And then we do some commerce partnerships with the Top Secret, where we run culinary sales on Mondays, and we're doing some stuff with Guilt Group on experience-based packages. So we're basically taking our network of experts and, you know, taking the content and finding different ways to monetize it.
Fabulous. I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, my God, I'm not even sure I completely understand this language.
Uh-oh. It must be the fact that I've been to school 3 times and gotten 3 degrees.
Yeah, I think that must be it. Yeah, either that or, you know, I'm just so hopeless about stuff like this. You know, I can only
not
think as far as, oh, yeah. I like to say that I just didn't get born with the money chip. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you don't need to. I think, you know, I always say this, and I was actually talking to my team about this. I said, in life, you should always pursue what you're most passionate about and always take the job that you would come to work every single day if you weren't even getting paid.
Well,
because that's the job that you're going to love the most, and that's what's going to make you the happiest.
I never work for money if I can work for free. I mean,
I know. Honestly, I've been working for free.
But I agree
since
with
I started
you.
This business, yeah. I have been working for free. And I got to tell you, I've never been so happy in my life.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
It's been the most rewarding experience.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, eventually it's going to pay off for you. Just like, you know, I think we all feel the same thing at Heritage Radio Network. It's like most of us work for free or for very little money. And it's really, really been fun and exciting. And it's great to see things like this grow. So
it's a great learning experience. And that's the best. You know, you'll take that with you forever. So whether you make money from it or not doesn't matter.
Exactly.
But it'll be a, you know, life-changing experience.
I think it's all about continuing to learn and continuing to, you know, just keep moving forward. I mean, that's totally my mantra in life. I never do the same thing for longer than about 10 years, actually. I've reinvented myself, I swear to God, every 10 years.
You should, though. That's part of the fun of being you, isn't it?
It is.
I love it.
Yeah, me too. Well, Divya, let me just identify the name of your site again. It's www.behindtheburner.com. Our guest today has been Divya Gugnani. Thank you so much. I do hope you'll come out another time, and we'll have a whole sort of like panel thing going on. I think that
would
be really interesting.
I would love to.
And let me take this opportunity to say happy holidays to you.
You
and I
too.
Hope 2010 is the best year ever. It's going to be mine.
I hope so.
And I'll be in touch. This was really fun. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for
take
having
care.
Me.
You betcha.
Take care.
Bye-bye. And let me say thank you to my boys in the booth, Jack Inslee, my producer, and Nat Wiener, my engineer. Thanks to Roberta's for their continuing support and sponsorship. And I wish you all the very best of the holidays and especially the best year ever.
And thank you, Katie, for being so awesome in 2009 and booking as many guests on a Sunday as most shows do in a week.
So. Yeah, I'll try to keep up the good work.
Yes.
I'll see you in 2 weeks, guys. Bye.